Aloha, this is Catherine Cruz. Thanks for joining us here on The Conversation, Hawaii Talks. It's Thursday, May 29th. We woke up to the headlines that the courts have halted President Trump's tariff hikes, but just in the last few hours, a federal appeals court paused that order. The developments are dizzying. We hear from the head of the Hawaii Pacific Trade Council. And Hawaii has joined other states in a lawsuit over funding cuts at the National Science Foundation. We talked to a Nobel Prize winner from Hawaii about the attack on research and the latest in the new frontier of gene editing. Plus, a story about roll call. What happens when lawmakers don't show up at the Capitol but still collect their per diem? And we hear from a restaurateur who's bringing a local tradition to New York City. The Big Apple gets a taste of musubi. You're tuned to The Conversation here on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. Coffee? Tea? Or tariffs? So much is happening in the courts. The on-again, off-again tariff hikes are ping-ponging as lawsuits are making their way through the courts. Just today, a federal appeals court put a pause on a lower court ruling from yesterday that would have forced the White House to remove duties deemed to be illegal. With all the back and forth, it's no surprise tariffs took center stage at a meeting earlier this month of trade councils in our nation's capital, the National Association of Economic Trade Councils. In attendance were Hawaii representatives, which included new chairman Byron Gu. Gu happens to be in the business of tea. Tea Chest Hawaii is the name of his company, which gives him the perspective of a business owner facing down the barrel of trade wars triggered by Donald Trump's move to shake up the trade imbalance. On The Conversation yesterday, we gave you the take of a coffee grower. Today, it's tea. Here's Gu.
Well, as you know, we don't have any tea industry domestic production, you know, in the U.S. One of my passion projects is to see a local tea industry bubble up and grow to something that would complement our world-renowned coffee industry here in Hawaii. But that's a very long process, and it takes a lot of input from many different stakeholders. So coming back to your question about how this round of tariffs is affecting us, you know, we import a lot of our base products. For instance, we bring in teas from India, which has a very robust industry, but also a very certifiable and transparent and traceable industry, which is why we choose to import more Indian teas than we do, let's say, in other countries like China. We find that the quality is better, the traceability is much better. And we've won some awards with those teas too, including Best Iced Tea in America. So hard to simply let go just because our president wants to charge us so much more now for the exact same product.
Well, you know, I know that there are teas that I've seen, you know, hibiscus tea and there's mamaki tea. So I don't know. Yeah. When we see those types of products on the market, are they blended?
They can be. We sell mamaki. We sell a whole range. We sell 14 different mamaki products. We have 100% pure, of course. Then we have blends that include them. But one thing that I learned recently, a statistic that is important to keep in mind, especially in regards to our import, a lot of manufacturing is no longer done in America. It's just moved offshore. So, for example, printing a small little tag that appears on the end of our tea bag strings, there isn't any domestic manufacturing for that. We actually have to go overseas to print that product. What's interesting is 56% of imports coming into our country are actually for inputs, like a tea tag, like the base tea that we use in some of our blends. They are not finished goods. And I think the fact that we don't differentiate between those two hurts actually domestic manufacturing. And inevitably, it will increase the cost of goods to U.S. citizens.
Well, I'm thinking of just like tea bags. Who makes the tea bags?
Yeah, we have to import that material as well. Yeah, so a lot of raw goods are being affected by these tariffs, which we have to decide as manufacturers. Do we pass it on? Do we absorb it? How do we cope with this increase in cost of doing business.
And you were just at a big conference in the nation's capital where we were talking about tariffs.
Yeah, this was the National Association of District Export Councils. There's 61 of them, either in a state or, for instance, if the state is large enough, like a Texas or a California, there'll be multiple district export councils within the state. There are 61 national councils. Hawaii Pacific Export Council oversees Hawaii as well as our Pacific territories like Guam, CNMI, and America Samoa. And a little bit of bragging, right? We won the National District Export Council 2 out of the last 4 years. So out of 61 decks, we've been doing pretty well.
Well, what was the tone of that conference? You know, what were you hearing?
A lot. It was very chaotic, first of all. Typically, these councils have a lot to do with regulation and how, for instance, very commodity-based grades of goods like, you know, steel, aluminum, graphite, how these are cataloged. So a lot of regulations goes on. But this year, it was incredibly different. The mood was a little bit nervous. The mood was a little bit of an uncertainty. And for sure, a lot of people were talking more about the imports than about the exports of goods because of the tariffs. You know, I see the long term, sort of the partial decoupling of our relationship with China. But, you know, for example, if you took it at face value, I think there's a 46% tariff that was slapped on Vietnam. And you would think on the surface, oh, you know, I thought we're friends with Vietnam, right? We fought in their war, et cetera. We, you know, freed them from communism. Why 46%? Well, if you trace what's been happening in China lately, over the last decade, there has been less and less investment internally in China, including by Chinese companies. What they have been doing is moving their manufacturing overseas to places like Thailand and Vietnam. So what's happening with imports out of Vietnam is in order to avoid the 145% tariff coming for goods coming in from China, they're trans-shipping products from China to Vietnam to the U.S. to get a lower tariff rate. And so there's a lot going on underneath the surface as to, you know, why these certain tariffs are the way they are. But it's all based upon, yeah, where are the supply chains? Where are goods coming from?
Well, I thought I heard in a story somewhere that trying to circumvent these tariffs, that's illegal, you know, by repackaging. If they're trying to repackage in Vietnam or someplace else, that might be a little iffy.
Or not even that, you know, just put an English pack, put a, you know, English language package on a Chinese toy, take that same container, load the container, ship it to Vietnam, and then ship it back. And what, they're already saving 100% in terms of the duty and tariff. So there's a lot of resourcefulness out there. And I think what you'll see is these very unusual supply chains happening around the world. What we realize is we got pretty, how do you want to, not complacent, but we were looking for efficient, cost-effective supply chains. And what we've seen with this latest round of tariffs is efficient and cost-effective doesn't mean resilient. You know, what we're finding is that a lot of the supply chains now are backed up. You know, it's kind of a stop-and-go mentality, like, okay, we've got 90 days to move this product and or this container, and so we're tripling our orders, you know, to try to get it out in 90 days before the next round of tariffs come. And we're seeing a lot of slowdown in the global supply chain.
Well, that's no way to run a business.
No, it's not.
We have been talking to Byron Gu. He's the chairman of the Hawaii Pacific Export Council and owner of a company called T-Chest Hawaii. We'll have more of our conversation right after a short break. Let's get back to a conversation we had with Byron Gu. He's in the business of tea, and he's also the chairman of the Hawaii Pacific Export Council. He just returned from a conference in our nation's capital. I understand that you just recently put a survey out to your members to try and get a sense as to what's happening now.
What was neat about the survey is it was a cross-section of all different kinds of sectors, business sectors, from manufacturers to retailers. We have wholesale distributors who've chimed in, even, you know, service and finance related companies, and everybody's getting affected. You know, 80% of the businesses that responded said, hey, okay, in some way, shape, or form, they're actually being affected. And the outcome is that the cost of business has just gone up for them. So that's pretty high. I mean, 80% of them are all being affected across multiple sectors.
And I did take a look at some of those numbers, and it looks like the majority of folks that responded, I think, were getting product from China.
Yeah, I mean, even healthcare, right? We get some really basic healthcare products from China. And so the sentiment to diversify supply chains, you know, that's been going on in the last five to 10 years, I mean, it's just been ramped up. It's on steroids now, and everybody's trying to shift around away from China.
Someone I know, I think, went to the dentist, and the hygienist told them that they get all their instruments from China.
Yeah, a lot of that has moved overseas.
So just interesting to see every aspect of our life is just affected in one way or another. You don't realize, you know, where it was made.
A very interesting story about exporting, right? At this national conference, the director of global policy for Toyota was on a panel. She reports to both the board, direct report to the board of Toyota USA, as well as back to Japan, to their corporate board. And very few people know this, that the largest factory that Toyota owns in the world actually is sitting in Kentucky. So it's in the U.S. And over the course of a four-decade relationship with the state of Kentucky, Toyota has built this big campus, the largest factory in their network. But then suppliers have actually gone and set up shop, built their own factories around it. So, you know, ancillary products and goods that go into the car, you've got factories sitting around the main plant in Kentucky. And what was interesting to me was that they, from that plant and from U.S. soil, they now export Toyota goods as well as parts, not just finished cars, but parts as well, to 63 countries. So yeah, the supply chain really today is very global, depending on the complexity of your product. And even for a small country like us, we will import from a variety of countries, looking for the right quality, looking for the right level of service and efficiency, as well as, hey, if we order this container and we need it by X date, is it going to be delivered on time at the right price, you know, in the right condition?
Yeah, it's a lot to take in every aspect of our life that's being affected. Any closing thoughts you want to leave our listeners with?
I think one of the things that I'm thinking about now is that panicking can sometimes be more costly than patience. What we're seeing, the mood in D.C., was a mood of uncertainty, and things were so dynamic. You know, what happened a week ago could be changed by an executive order next week. And so I think it's important to stay the course, to not panic in this kind of environment, and just make sure that, you know, we support the people that support us. In other words, at the community level, continue to do business with the people you do business with and you trust. And then even internationally, continue to, you know, support the people who have supported our business and helped us to get to where we want to go and what helping us get to our goals. So I think that's the main thing. It's so easy. It's like a trade wind breeze. You know, all these changes that's happening in D.C. is very easy to change policy and do this and do that. But who knows? Who knows where it's going to be, you know, 1 year from now,
well,
let alone one term, one cycle from now.
Well, I guess, like the British say, stay calm and have a cup of tea.
Yes, definitely. Thank you, Catherine. That's a good reminder for me.
All right.
Stay calm and have a cup of tea.
All right. Thanks so much, Byron. Really appreciate your time today.
Enjoy. Thank you.
Well, that was Byron Gu, chairman of the Hawaii Pacific Export Council, talking about a recent conference in Washington, D.C., and the effect of tariffs on the business of tea. Hawaii has joined a lawsuit against the Trump administration over the halting of National Science Foundation money. It is a sign of times in the world of science and politics. Well, it's in that space that our next story takes on new meaning. In the news earlier this month, there was a story about baby KJ. At 7 months, he made headlines because of a custom treatment he received for a rare genetic disorder. That treatment was thanks to gene editing and the CRISPR technique. We reached out to Jennifer Doudna, who, along with her colleague Emmanuel Charpentier, won the Nobel Prize in Chemistry in 2020 for that discovery. Doudna's connection to Hawaii is that she grew up on the Big Island and graduated from Hilo High. Here's Doudna.
I couldn't be more excited about where science is headed. I think, like many scientists right now, there's sort of two things going on that are really big news. One is that, you know, science is a bit under threat right now in the country, and we'd like to figure out how to turn that around. You know, it's a really kind of a strange irony in a way, because scientifically, things could not be more exciting, as you were just saying. You know, there's so many amazing discoveries that are happening, applications that are happening with new technologies like CRISPR, and we're just seeing the, you know, the opportunities in science just expanding tremendously. So I want to find a way to communicate that better, and I think that's something that you can do, you know, is to really make sure that people understand the value of science and how it impacts everybody's lives in the end.
Well, when I read the story about that six-month-old getting the gene editing treatment that was customized for him, you know, it did bring tears to my eyes, because I'm a new grandma. And when I think of a child like that, just the breakthrough in science, it just has given him a chance. That's awesome.
Exactly. Yeah, I'm at a conference right now, and you know, people are just amazed. I mean, this is a conference of scientists, but nonetheless, I think we're all feeling the same way. You know, just that it's really exciting to see the advances that are being made, like in that example with the baby. So.
And when I was going through my bookshelf, and then I came across your book, you know, and it's hard to think that it's been like 10 years, right? It's just crazy.
It's crazy, yeah. Yeah, 2012 was the publication of that original work. And so, yeah, it's amazing to see where the field is at now.
You know, when we last chatted, I know you were looking at bacteria in our gut. How's that research going?
Really, really exciting. I think there's so many opportunities there. It's a whole area of science that is ripe for more discovery, because a lot of the work on bacteria has focused on individual organisms that are, you know, grown in petri dishes in the lab. And yet we know that in nature, that's actually not how these bugs grow. They tend to be in communities with many different kinds of bugs that are all growing together. And so one of the things that we've been very interested to do at the Innovative Genomics Institute is to use CRISPR to understand the fundamental biology of those communities of organisms. We call them microbiomes, and then to manipulate them in ways that will have real value. And one of the things, I think you and I might have talked about this, one of the applications that we're most excited about right now is using CRISPR in the cow rumen, so making targeted changes in the gut bacteria of cattle to reduce methane emissions.
Where do you see that going, the applications in agriculture?
Yeah, the exciting thing there is that we know that we can actually use CRISPR in that way. We know we can use it to reduce methane emissions, and we're working now to figure out how to deliver it efficiently into cattle, and ideally into young cattle like calves, in a way that would permanently alter their microbiome so that they will remove the methane emitting microbes and also turn that energy into milk and meat. So it's a way to, you know, have everybody win. You know, farmers are happy with it as a technology, and it benefits the planet.
This kind of research, I mean, it doesn't happen overnight. I mean, you know, researchers toil over this in the lab, and sometimes, you know, it's like, yeah, we got it. We figured this out, right? But sometimes it's just like trying to follow the clues to figure out what's really going on, you know, with ourselves in our body.
Right. And this is what I think is so interesting about scientific research, is that what you said is so true. We don't know the answers. And that's why we're investigating. And a lot of times research projects get started because a scientist is wondering about how something works. and they start investigating, and often the science leads in unexpected directions. That's certainly our experience with CRISPR. And so in the case of, you know, using CRISPR in microbiomes, we're really excited about discovering new biology and figuring out how these organisms grow together. And also, on a very practical level, being able to reduce methane emissions would have tangible impacts in a good way on the planet and the environment, especially if we're able to do it in ways that are beneficial to farmers. So everybody wins.
How do you deal with, let's say, frustration when you know that it does take time and it takes funding? And as you mentioned, in this climate, when you see projects just shut down in their tracks, you know, somebody has just dedicated years of their lives, you know, working towards something, and then the money's gone.
You're right. It's really heartbreaking to see that happen for trainees in particular, you know, people who are starting out in their career, and I want to see them get a chance. You know, I'd like to see them have the same opportunities that I feel like I had. And I'm working hard to, you know, at least in our lab and in our institute to make that possible. But I do think that it does reveal to me that there's a kind of a disconnect between what you just said about the way that scientific research progresses and the common understanding of how science is funded and, you know, why do we fund science? You know, why spend taxpayer money so that students and researchers are able to pursue ideas they think are interesting? And I'll just point out that many of the major advances that have happened over the, you know, last certainly few decades have been the result of that kind of taxpayer-funded research, a lot of it conducted by people who are simply curious about nature and trying to figure out why things work the way they do, and then paying attention, you know, when they came across something interesting, recognizing that it might have the ability to solve real problems. And as a result, the U.S. has been a leader in science for several decades, and we've had the ability to, you know, use scientific discoveries to drive our economy. It had an enormous impact on job creation and, of course, coming up with solutions to medical and other kinds of challenges. So I'd like us to embrace that, and I certainly hope that that's one of the takeaways from this story that you're doing.
I don't know what you've seen this year, you know, in your lab at your university with funding drying up. Are your projects okay?
Well, you never know. I mean, things change, it seems, almost on a daily basis now, but we're just keeping our heads down, keeping our motivation high and continuing to focus on doing the best work that we can.
As you reflect back on your research, over the years there have been, you know, headlines where there have been some breakthroughs, you know, thanks to CRISPR. What's that like when you read stories like we saw with this little baby KJ, and what is happening out there, you know, applying this research?
Well, the baby KJ story was one where our institute was, you know, one of the key contributors to that. So we had the inside track on it, and it was amazing to hear in kind of real time how that therapy was developed by the clinicians in collaboration with the IGI, and we were able to get companies involved in making the molecules that were ultimately used in therapy, working with the Food and Drug Administration to make sure that it was safely tested and validated before use. And, you know, all of those pieces coming together. I mean, it's really gratifying to see people working together like that. And I'm excited because I think that this is just the very beginning. This is going to be possible to do, I think, for many more diseases in the future. So that's one area where there's a lot of momentum right now and where I think we're going to see really rapid advancing in the use of CRISPR. Another is, as we've been discussing, is in dealing with some of the challenges in the environment. You know, as the temperature changes, as climate change happens, we need to be able to help microbes and plants to adjust quickly. And that's something that CRISPR also can provide. So I'm excited about those kinds of applications. And then, of course, you know, as a researcher, I'm also always, always excited about the kinds of discoveries that people are making using CRISPR. It continues to be driving a lot of very fundamental, very interesting science that I hear about a lot. You don't read about it in headlines, but it's the kind of, you know, kind of research that will drive tomorrow's breakthroughs.
Yeah, I guess that's the way to look at it, right? Tomorrow's breakthroughs and the possibilities.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Well, I hope you one day get to meet KJ if you haven't already.
You know, here's the thing. I haven't met KJ, but I just last week met Victoria Gray, who is the first U.S. patient to receive the CRISPR therapy for sickle cell disease. That was an incredible experience to hear personally from her about her story. And, you know, I couldn't help reflecting on, you know, we are two women, both mothers. We came from very different parts of the U.S. She was born and raised in Mississippi. I grew up in Hawaii. And, you know, our paths might not have crossed except for this, you know, this extraordinary opportunity in using CRISPR to treat sickle cell disease. So I thought that was a really, for me, kind of one of those, you know, special, precious moments in life when you meet somebody who has really changed things and changed my perspective on why we do science. And I just found that to be incredibly moving.
Well, I can't wait to see what happens to KJ. I mean, I know it's not a cure, but, you know, I think everybody's rooting for him and that he's got a, you know, a chance at a normal life. And so everybody's hoping for the best.
Exactly. Exactly. And may there be many more, right? That's the future. Yeah.
That's the future. That's why science is important. And that was Jennifer Doudna, 2020 winner of the Nobel Prize in Chemistry for her work in CRISPR gene editing.
The news and music you hear on HPR are supported by local organizations reaching you with their message and making a difference every day. Mahalo to Maui Pops Orchestra, Ulu Pono Initiative, and Hastings and Pleadwell. They believe just as you do in the power of public radio. See a full list of our sponsors at hawaiipublicradio.org.
In his epic composition, The Lightbringer, Hawaii Symphony composer-in-residence Michael Thomas Fumai portrays an epic battle between good and evil. Tell me, what was the genesis of this piece, The Lightbringer?
Well, this is a piece that really starts with the title, The Lightbringer, and it has to do with the devil, an unsavory figure in Christianity, and it is something I was always very interested in because I was brought up Catholic and read Revelations and, you know, was kind of trying to picture the genesis of what would become the devil. And so I wanted to write music that really foretold this battle of the angels that we see in that chapter of the Bible. And that's what The Lightbringer is.
Stand firmly on the side of good by supporting 24 hours of classical music each and every day on HPR2. Visit HawaiiPublicRadio.org to donate.
Support for HPR comes from the University of Hawaii Foundation. Its 4UH for Hawaii campaign connects donors with UH to seek new ways to sustain and conserve island resources. UHFoundation.org.
Remember how back in school your report cards reflected your attendance? Well, during the legislative session, there is a roll call. HPR reporter Ashley Mizzou spent some time looking at the attendance record, which takes on some new light as lawmakers are in line for a big pay hike. Good morning.
Good morning.
Yeah, I mean, taxpayers want to know, right? If we're going to be paying our lawmakers more, we want to make sure they're out there doing work.
Right, exactly. And I think, you know, Hawaii's legislative session lasts, there's 60 days of floor session, but there aren't really requirements for state lawmakers to be present. Lawmakers do need to notify leadership in the House and the Senate if they are not going to be present for the day during the session. But there aren't really standards for how many days they can miss or what is an acceptable absence. I spoke with, you know, Colin Moore, and this is what he had to say, a political analyst.
It's really up to the individual lawmakers I mean, ultimately, their bosses are the electorate. So short of ethical violations, the legislature is a unique place to work because it's not like there's an HR department. If you can explain it to your voters, then you're not going to lose your job for not showing up to work, essentially. I think that it depends. I mean, legislators will often say, and I think correctly, that there's a lot of votes that don't matter that much, and maybe their time is better spent going to a community meeting or reviewing some other piece of legislation.
And, you know, one situation that has brought this to light is Representative Ellie Cochran, who represents Lahaina in Maui. She was absent 51 out of the 60 days of the legislature this year. And in a written statement to us, you know, she said she felt that she was just more needed in her district to help Lahaina fire survivors and deal with on-the-ground problems rather than be present at the Capitol. You know, she said she still kept up with legislation and came back to vote on bills that were important to her, like the regulations of midwifery. But notably, she wasn't there for the last week of session when most of the major bills passed. And then she was also dealing with some health issues of a family member at the start of the session this year. But because she represents a district on Maui, she receives $225 a day to cover living expenses on Oahu. You know, each neighbor island lawmaker gets that per diem, which comes out to at least $15,000 for the legislative session, regardless of whether they're actually physically present here or not. Senate President Ron Cochi says that lawmakers often tell him why they'll be absent because of events in their district.
So I'm aware that they are on legitimate Senate business and missing. But right now you get your per diem whether you show up or not. And we have not changed anything. So if you're absent, you're still going to get the per diem check. What we need to look at is what would that policy be and how should we implement/enforce it?
And he said, you know, it's a really difficult situation because you can't really dock lawmakers their per diem per day they miss during the legislative session because they're often renting spaces for months at a time. So say, you know, you're a lawmaker and you have to be here for that 4-month period between January and beginning of May. Some of them think it's or come across, you know, situations where it's more feasible to, you know, just rent a apartment or rent a room or something for that period of time. And so maybe you have some type of event in your district and you don't go to floor session that day because you're in your district on the neighbor island, that doesn't necessarily mean you're not paying that expense for the entirety of the session. So docking them that day of pay, per diem pay, Cochi says, doesn't really make a lot of sense either. And, you know, Representative Cochran, you know, isn't the only lawmaker that has felt her time maybe is better spent outside of the day-to-day legislative process. You know, Senator Brenton Awa received backlash on social media for missing conference committee. It's one of the final stages of the legislative process where a small committee of senators and representatives will come together to negotiate a final version of a bill. Awa was at the Merry Monarch Festival, but he says he purposely doesn't actually participate in conference committee because he also missed it in 2024.
This thing is a waste of our time. I'm not going to go to any. And beyond that, the people don't have a voice. And that is the number one reason why I don't go, is because there is no testimony. That period is over. And we as senators don't get to speak to represent our people. You show up and you rubber stamp yes or no.
And he pointed out that, you know, many of the bills get postponed each day of conference because they don't have permission from the money committees to actually ever vote on it. So it just gets rolled on day after day. And a lot of lawmakers are kind of just running up and down at the Capitol, being present physically at each of these votes just for the vote to be postponed to another day. And usually the most controversial measures don't actually get voted on in conference until like the final hours of that deadline. And this type of decision, you know, isn't necessarily possible for some lawmakers. You know, the ones that work on really big pieces of legislation, like this year, the green fee or property insurance stabilization, or if you're a lawmaker who chairs a committee, you know, these are all things that are being finalized at the last second and you cannot be not physically present during this time. Unlike lawmakers, the governor and lieutenant governor earn 21 days of vacation and 21 days of sick leave at the same rate as other employees, and they do have to submit that to their human resources office if they're going to take off time for that. Moore says that lawmakers' attendance records aren't necessarily the best indicator of whether they're actually good at their jobs, because not every single vote is crucial. And being a lawmaker often comes with more than just voting on the floor, you know. Where attendance really does hurt is often when it comes to campaigning.
Most people have to show up to work, and they understandably see voting at the legislature as elected officials' job. I mean, it is a huge part of their job. So, I mean, I think most legislators are loath to miss a bunch of votes because it looks really bad. And it's something that any good opponent is going to be using to try to defeat them.
Becomes ammunition, right?
Exactly. And at the end of the day, you know, the real repercussion of not showing up or having these kind of poor attendance records is that an opponent can use them, like they said. And ultimately, it's the voters who are going to decide whether or not you get to keep your job in the coming years. And, you know, all of this is kind of coming, as you said, lawmakers are supposed to get raises starting in 2027. That's going to bring their salaries from $74,000 to $97,000. And then by 2030, that'll go up to $114,000 a year. Senate President Cochi also pointed out that lawmakers are not compensated for working outside of general work hours and are often working in the interim, and you can still contact their offices all year round, regardless of whether they're in session or not. But because of all of this, you know, House Speaker Nadine Nakamura wrote in an email that leadership is working on a policy regarding absences that is supposed to take effect next year.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I think it's reasonable to expect that if we are going to give the lawmakers a fat pay raise, that they better be out there working for the people that they represent. You know, I was monitoring a neighborhood board meeting, and someone, you know, complimented Senator Sharon Milwaukee for showing up to every single neighborhood board meeting, even while she was in session, you know?
Yeah, and I think that that is kind of what brings up an interesting concept of, you know, what is a good job? Like, how do you determine your lawmaker is doing a good job? And that's going to be a different definition for everyone. For example, you know, Senator Moriwaki, she lives on Oahu, so going back and forth to these neighborhood meetings are really a lot easier during the legislative session than, say, somebody who represents Kauai or Maui or Big Island. You know, these are all kind of things that their constituents end up having to decide whether or not they feel like the efforts that they're putting in are doing a good job, not necessarily just their attendance record physically at the Capitol.
Right, yeah. I mean, you know, if you're a kid and you play hooky, right? I mean,
there's a right. Or like a regular job too, like us here, we can't just leave.
Yeah, can't just like not show up, right?
Yeah,
and,
yeah.
And so, yeah, I think that's, I think it's a reasonable thing to ask, you know, House leadership and Senate leadership to look into as we move forward.
And I think that that's what they're planning on doing.
Yeah.
So,
all right, we'll see what they come up with.
Yeah.
But thanks so much, Ashley.
Thanks.
We've been talking to HPR's Ashley Mizuo. You can read her story about Maui Rep. Ellie Cochran's job attendance on HawaiiPublicRadio.org. It is being billed as New York's first Hawaii musubi store. Kain Musubi is the brainchild of Chi'ian Chan, who grew up in Honolulu's Chinatown. After moving to New York, Chan longed for nostalgic flavors. He started making and selling musubi on Facebook Marketplace during the pandemic, and the business has grown since then. And now, Chan is launching a brick-and-mortar store devoted to the musubi later this summer. He spoke with The Conversation's Maddie Bender about the kind musubi, that is, starting with his love for the local snack.
Being a local boy growing up in Hawaii, it's just found everywhere. I've eaten so much musubi, and, you know, my mom would make my brother and I musubis for field trips as early as elementary school. But I couldn't tell you the first time, but because I've had so many of them, and like all other kids that grew up in Hawaii, it's a daily part of life.
And so you started through Facebook as a pop-up. Talk about why you decided to even do that in the first place.
So during the pandemic, a lot of families would make ends meet by making delicious food because there were no restaurants open during that time. People would take to Facebook to sell their food. And so seeing a lot of that happening in Hawaii, and I wanted to try that channel in New York. And so after I made my musubi, and I thought, wow, this is really good. I think that New Yorkers would love this. So I decided to post it on our neighborhood Facebook group in Hell's Kitchen. And it just started taking off. We started getting a lot of traction, popularity. And so through the Facebook group, we met someone with ties to Hawaii. And she had a friend that owns a sushi restaurant in the Upper West Side. And so we made that connection. And eventually we worked out a deal to start our pop-up at their sushi restaurant. We've been doing that for about 2 years prior to them closing down.
And what's in your recipe? How do you make your musubi stand out?
So our classic local musubi pays homage to the simple musubi in Hawaii. It's just rice mixed with furikake. We add our homemade teriyaki sauce and we layer it with a spam wrapped around with seaweed, the nori. But we have a lot of different variations of our musubi as well. So we also have another classic called the ono, which is basically the local, but also has a Japanese tamagoyaki egg omelet on top. And we also have some not as conventional flavors. We had to adapt our menu to the East Coast market because not everyone eats spam, especially in the Upper West Side. So we started playing around with different flavors. We started with a tuna salad, a Japanese style tuna salad, layered with cucumber. And then we also started using tofu as a vegan option. And now we also use a vegan spam, which is made by Omni Foods. They have a manufacturing company in the US, but started from Hong Kong actually. And we're also most recently added a king oyster mushroom.
When you said people on the Upper West Side might not be accustomed to spam, we had to cater a menu a different way. I was wondering how your business looks different than if you were doing it in Hawaii.
Well, obviously in Hawaii, everyone knows spam. But the thing about East Coast is that there has been a negative connotation with spam. And so when we would have customers curious about what spam is or what musubi even is, I would just educate them that it's a local comfort food from Hawaii and that it's made of pork. So basically, I just tell our customers, if you eat hot dogs, you'll love spam. It's just in a different shape, but I think it tastes better. So we've had a good amount of regulars now that has either have never tried spam or never heard of musubi, and they love it so much that they just come back all the time and they become our loyal regulars.
And so, I mean, running a food business is hard anywhere. The margins are really tough. And you alluded to the fact that it's really tough in a place like New York where rent for spaces is so high. So, I mean, what motivates you to do that?
Well, my biggest motivator was that I wanted to grow a family business. And I really wanted to bring the spam musubi to New York City. I want to educate people on the East Coast that spam is not bad. It's delicious. It was World War II, rations, but it's eaten all over the world. Hawaii has the largest percentage of consumption of spam in the US. And so I just wanted to bring it to New York and show them how tasty it can be with the right preparation, and that musubi is not just food from Hawaii. It's something that can be shared like everything else in Hawaii. You know, it's very communal and it brings everyone together in communities, especially in Hawaii, how small it is. So I want to just bring a piece of Hawaii to New York City and beyond.
And what's your vision for the restaurant? What will it look like and what can people order?
So it's very simple. It's going to be a grab and go. We are planning to have standing only counter space. And we are looking at it to be very simple, very classic. We're not going to have decorations with hulas or grass skirts, surfboards, nothing like that. I grew up in Chinatown as a skateboarder, so I have some plans to decorate the inside as such, to keep it simple. And yeah, you know, it's going to be clean, natural.
Yeah, let me see if I can articulate this, but it's interesting talking about how on the one side, there's some adapting or making the idea of spam more palatable to a quote unquote American palate. But then on the other hand, you're not going to like stereotype or bring in these aspects of Hawaii that people on the mainland might assume dominate the culture. So I guess, how do you walk that line, or how do you strike a balance between appealing to your customer and being true to what your experience has been in Hawaii?
I think the biggest thing would be just educating, just the story of how spam was to become about, the story of how I lived in Hawaii and how we're trying to bring the musubi to New York. Again, when we had a lot of customers that were very curious about what musubis were or about spam, I just talked to them very simply, my story, how people grew up eating spam, how you can find spam musubis at every mom and pop shop, 7-Eleven, and people will be curious, especially if they hear 7-Eleven selling spam musubi. So it's all about just having them going in with an open mind, trying something new. And New Yorkers love to try new things. So it's really just getting them to take that first bite.
I like that, of like one bite and the CO is a good idea.
And it's either you like it or you don't. But I always tell them, just keep an open mind. Again, if you eat pork and you love hot dogs, you'll love spam.
And any advice that you would have for small business owners or aspiring business owners on the continent or here in Hawaii, people who have ideas but aren't sure how to make that happen?
I would say, if you have a dream, chase it. Or for the local people, go for broke. Just do it. You never know what's going to happen until you try. You know, if you fail, you get up and you try again. That's what living life is all about. Not just business, but just everyday aspects of life. You fall down, you get up and you try again. I want to thank all of my friends and family that have helped support me, even from the idea of starting a musubi shop to just words of praise as we are going through this next chapter. I want the local Hawaii people to know that I will represent Hawaii in its true form, as you know, with community and just all the love that Hawaii has to offer. But I just want to thank the local people, and I want to represent the local people in Hawaii.
That was Chi Ian Chan, owner of Kind Musubi, New York's first Hawaii musubi store, which plans to open this August on Manhattan's Upper West Side, offering spam musubi and more. Chan spoke with HPR's Maddie Bender recently. You can look for links on our website later today. Well, that does it for us today. Up tomorrow, we plan to hear from a scientist about the plans to open up a Pacific Reserve area to commercial fishing. Give us some feedback. Call or talkback line 808-792-8217 or email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Want to listen back to something you heard? Find the conversation as a podcast on Spotify, Apple, or on our website, hawaiipublicradio.org. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow for more of The Conversation.